Okay. That was it. Sean, it's very nice to meet you. Thank you so much for being on. Do you have a page on like a professor page on USASC?
Yes, it's not kept up to date. Something I'm going to work on this year, actually.
Fair enough. I was looking up last night, and I was like, I had to go to resources outside the school. I couldn't really find a whole lot, but you've done a few really interesting things.
Yeah, some people who Google me go, is this all the same person?
Yeah. No, I could see that for sure. So you are a sports scientist? That's one of the things I could find.
Yeah, I would call myself a sports engineer.
Okay.
Doing sports science and sports engineering, mm-hmm. right now focusing on curling. But having spent a lot of time with speed skating, short track, long track, mm-hmm. some cross country skiing, some alpine skiing, some sliding sports. So, yeah, sports engineering and sports science.
Great. And you were a speed skater at one point, correct?
Yeah, I didn't start till late. Towards the end of my undergrad, I took a learn to speed skate course at the University of Waterloo. There was like six people who started. I was the only one who finished skating alone at the end.
Oh, no.
And I had trouble. I was one of the worst speed skaters I've ever seen to start speed skating. I met up with a few friends who were approximately my age, or at least generation.
Yeah.
And we formed a group, and we were sort of like a senior men's group. And we were one of the more entertaining races in a meet, because we'd fall all the time.
Okay.
We were like the Keystone Cops on ice, and we were just sliding and falling and falling, sliding and running into each other. And it was pretty funny. But got half decent. In short track, I was never particularly good, but then moved to Edmonton from Ontario and started doing long track there. And, you know, it was half decent, mm-hmm. sort of provincial team level.
That's cool. Is there anything, like, so the difference between long track and short track, is it just the track length, or is there, I don't know anything
about Well, it's, that is the main sort of main difference, sort mm-hmm. of. Superficially, the short track's done on a short track and long track's done on a long track, but the skates are different, the equipment's different, the psychology is different, the types of people who do it are different. You have to have a different psychological mindset for short track, because it's who finishes first, whereas in long track it's your time, and those are very different. Psychological mindsets.
For sure.
Also, short track, if you've ever watched on TV or anything, it's very chaotic. Anything can happen. You kind of have to take the attitude that, you know, that's short track if you get disqualified or knocked out. But in long track, it's more under your own control.
Oh, I see.
And so, and it's sort of more purely speed or endurance or power, whatever the distance is going to be. The distances are similar. I mean, there's a lot of overlap, 500, 1,000, 1,500, 3,000. But it's a totally different sport psychologically and physiologically and biomechanically. Well, biomechanically, there's some similarities, but it's actually grown farther apart with time.
Oh, okay.
Because the short track technique, skating technique, is now a technique that's quite different than the long track. Even though it's both skating.
Yeah. Different in what ways?
Well, in the last 10, 15, 20 years, you keep your short, if you're doing short track, you keep your blades on the ice as you're pushing off and recovering, which you would never do in long track. Also in long track, you've got clap skates, which are the skates that sort of
clap
off the back, like they're pivoted at the front and come off the heel. That's not in short track. Short track, they're what we call hardtails. They're attached fully to the boot.
Mm-hmm.
So that creates some significant changes in biomechanics. And in long track, you have long distances and on straightaways and corners, so you have longer stride lengths and that sort of thing. And you don't have to worry about bumping into people, except on the crossovers. So it's quite different. But I like both. They both have different appeals to me, but I ended up coaching short track and long track and doing long track.
Mm.
So I got out of doing short track.
Yeah.
So
you've been pretty involved in it since, like, outside of coaching as well, since you started, correct?
Yeah, I sort of rose through the ranks through administratively in the sport to be on the board of directors of Speed Skating Canada for a while, heading some committees there on safety, and then doing announcing for World Cups, World Championships, and eventually Olympics.
Yeah.
So in situ announcing, so not like on TV or something, but in the venue. At the Sochi Olympics and then the Pyeongchang Olympics. And I attended the Vancouver Olympics as a board member of Speed Skating Canada, but I wasn't announcing there or anything.
So. Is it difficult to announce? Like do you have to have
surprisingly.
I was gonna say you have to have a pretty intensive knowledge of the all the athletes, right?
Yep, and
or extensive.
To be honest, one of the more you're absolutely right. we actually prepare a sheet on each of the athletes. All their times, where they're from, personal interests, history, all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. Like a page on each person. But the hardest part is pronouncing their names correctly.
Oh, yeah, I imagine. Especially at the Olympics, with people from all over the planet. Yeah.
Right. So we actually, at the Olympics, have the luxury of meeting each of the skaters and saying, how do you want your name pronounced?
Mm.
Which, you know, sounds fairly straightforward, but sometimes they'll say their name and you go, okay, can you? And then you repeat it to make sure you got it.
Yeah.
And they go, no, it's,
yeah.
It's like, I thought that's what I said.
That's awesome.
So that can get tricky, but, and, you know, I think we do a pretty good job at that, but the real heat, the real anxiety is medal ceremonies and stuff like that.
Mm.
Because then you'll have some king or some president or some queen or something coming out to present medals. And if you get that name wrong, you're in big trouble.
Yeah.
And you only have like 5 minutes to figure it out. Sometimes nobody can even tell you how to pronounce it, which is very stressful.
Yeah.
So that didn't happen too many times, fortunately, but, when you're 1 minute away from introducing them and you don't know how to pronounce their name, it's like you're sweating bullets.
I was going to say your heart rate's probably going up pretty quick there.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I imagine. I would never even thought about that for medal ceremonies, but
yeah, it's, the most at the Olympics, most medal ceremonies are separate from the sport. So they'll do it in the evening and they'll do them all together. But on the last day or two of the Olympics, they don't have time for that. So, they did the medal ceremonies at the venues. So it's only for 1 or 2 days. And it's interesting. There's a sort of a tempo to the Olympics. You know, the first day or two, everybody's kind of nervous.
Oh, yeah, I imagine.
And I'm talking about the staff and the volunteers and stuff because, you know, most people haven't done this before. And everybody's pretty nervous. But after 2 or 3 days, you settle in, you get comfortable. And then 10 and 11 days in, you're starting to get sloppy because it actually gets kind of repetitive after a while.
I bet, yeah.
And, you know, the events, that like calling the races aren't, that's not repetitive, but everything else is.
Mm-hmm.
So you get sloppy towards the end. And so the challenge at the front is not to be too nervous. And the challenge at the end is to not be too complacent.
Yeah.
And then at the end you have things like, you know, introduce the queen and king of whatever. And so it's interesting. It's a cool experience. I really am glad I had the experience. It's not at all relaxing. It's a lot of hard work. It's 12-hour days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 12 hours of work. You go back to wherever you're staying and just flop and and rest and
I imagine
get ready for the next day. And you got to pace your voice too.
Yeah.
I didn't know that the first time I did it much. And almost lost my voice, which is, you know, you might as well quit at that point.
Yeah, at that point, yeah.
So you really have to nurse your voice through the 2 weeks.
Do you have any techniques for that, for nursing your voice?
Well, you know, warm tea, lemon and honey, you really have to, and not talking when you don't need to,
mm-hmm.
Outside of announcing.
My dad's got a buddy that's a musician, and he comes in for my dad's birthday. He'll do a couple sets at our lake each year. And he was saying that the last time he was there, he was saying that afterwards he learned a trick of when he's done his set, he just takes a straw and just blows through that for like 10 minutes, just off and on. And apparently, really, he said it was like he noticed like a night and day difference going from like if he was doing sets back to back, like right. The next day, his voice would be like much better afterwards. So.
And do you know how that works?
He did explain it to me. I can't remember what it was, but yeah.
Blowing through a straw.
Yeah. So I'm sure somebody's done some research on it, maybe, but yeah. So.
Well, you know, one of the things I've learned in sports science, sports engineering is that as we try to understand how top athletes do what they do and top coaches for them, there's the art and there's the science. Right. And the art is always ahead of the science. The science is trying to catch up to the art. Mm-hmm. If you do really well, the science can maybe push the art forward. But you know, what a coach knows, what an athlete knows, is generally beyond your understanding until you've spent all many, many years studying it, like mm-hmm. they have, like the athletes and the coaches have.
Yeah.
And so getting involved with speed skating first, it helped a bit because I knew the sport, but I didn't know it at the Olympic level. And that is sort of a new level of performance that I wasn't familiar with personally.
Well, they're masters. Right?
So. What's that?
They're masters of what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. And they're pushing the boundaries too.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, somebody like Jeremy Witherspoon, who's a great Canadian sprinter, he was always, always, always looking for ways to improve, and you know, never satisfied with what he was doing. So, how can I get better?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, those very, very top level athletes are, in my experience, very process driven. They're not driven by the end; they're driven by the means. So, they're not like, you know, I want the gold, there, I want to get better. And if they're continuously focused on that, then they will, and maybe eventually they will get the gold medal or whatever.
Mm.
But they're always focused on self-improvement.
Yeah. I've been looking into that a little bit myself. Not really looking into it, but hearing a lot more about that kind of stuff recently in athletes. And I've heard that lots, is that the people that are the world champions are not, it's not because they're winning all the time. It's just because that's all they do. They've all their time is spent getting better at what they're doing. So.
Right, and that's easier said than done as well, because you know, how do you get better?
Mm-hmm.
That's not always obvious. It's not always easy. Obviously, there's a lot of practice, but if you just do repetitive stuff, that actually probably doesn't help you get much better. You have to vary it up. You have to work on your weaknesses, but not to the point where you're psychologically sort of damaging yourself. So it's easier said than done, but they work at getting better.
Yeah.
And you know, each year is another opportunity to start afresh and start new, which is also a cool thing too. I mean, the speed skating season is about 10 months from sort of start of dry land training and activities like that to the competitive season. And then you have a 2 month break or something, but you need that break because psychologically your brain sort of comes back after that break with a reset and you have a chance to do things differently. Like at the end of a season, you can't do anything differently.
Yeah.
Your brain's sort of set for what you've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to, like if you're a baseball pitcher or something, you want to change your pitch, how you're throwing, and that's hard to change. And taking a break from the sport gives your brain a chance to sort of give you a reset.
That makes sense.
So with skating, you know, you can come back and try new things in the summer and early fall, see if it'll work better and that sort of thing. So it's, sport has taught me a lot. Coaching has taught me a lot. It's very similar to teaching. And I found that they have both informed each other.
Mm. Yeah, I'd imagine for sure. Outside of coaching and teaching, you also designed a safety system for speed skating. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, one of the designers. Short track speed skating is done on hockey rinks, typically.
Okay.
On hockey rinks. And hockey rinks are boarded, so you got boards around the ring. If you fall on short track, you slam into the boards, and that's not very good. Mm-hmm. So you put pads there. And the nature of the pads, you know, we did a lot of research work on what are good pads and bad pads and necessary amounts and all that sort of thing. So that was interesting. There's a pad standard in Canada that's something that I helped develop. And then at the international level, or the very highest sort of Olympic level, there are facilities around the world now where there are no boards. It's kind of like a sort of a specific figure skating rink, almost. Like figure skating rinks, if they're just made for figure skating, don't have boards. It'd be kind of like that. But but even not even a lip around the rink. It's just, this would just be ice and a wall of pads. So if you hit the pads would move. That makes them much safer. So Calgary, at the Calgary Olympic Oval, they had a system like that, and we worked on some improvements and optimizations, which got used in Salt Lake and Beijing and some other places. So we were trying to make, you know, a better, safer pad system. And that got me really interested in sports safety because, as with anything in engineering design, there are trade-offs. And it turns out that, you know, short trackers especially, they get concussions. But they're wearing helmets. And they actually don't usually hit their head on the ice very often. They don't get concussions from that typically. They get concussions from hitting their heads on the soft pads, which is kind of weird. You're wearing a helmet, you hit soft pads, and you get a concussion.
I would have never put that together. Yeah.
Well, there are other sports like that. There's horse racing, like jockeys have the problem as well. They hit soft ground and they get a concussion and they're wearing helmets. Aerialists in skiing and artistic skiing, I mean, they come down on soft snow targets. They're wearing helmets. They also have similar issues. And it's probably more around whiplash than it is the nature of the impact itself. And the whiplash coming from, if you go into these pads or surfaces in a relaxed fashion, well, your head and your body are connected by the neck, and if there's some flopping around, you can get high rotations, and that can cause the concussion symptoms.
If it's only whiplash, it's not a concussion, though. Is that correct?
Well, that's a good question. One of the mechanisms of getting a concussion is whiplash. So if you say, well, you only got whiplash, does that mean concussion? I mean, concussion is a continuum. It's not like you got one or you didn't. It's just how bad was it? Sometimes it's not so bad. It's not even detectable. You know, a light concussion, a heavy concussion, etc. So it's a continuum. But the funny thing is with the pads, you kind of want them to be soft, because if I go in feet first or in an awkward angle, if they're too stiff, my legs are going to break. You don't want that.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a good time.
But the softer they are, the more likely you're probably going to get a concussion.
It's so strange.
So you have to trade that off.
Yeah.
Which is not a... And we, you know, we realized this just before the Vancouver Olympics, where we had designed some of the crash pads for short track and long track. And it's like, you know, you can't make a perfect system. So... And one of the key lessons there, I think we learned, is that the number one way to prevent sports injuries is how you behave. Behavioral changes are the biggest payoff for preventing sports injuries. But most people think, you know, it's the equipment. It's not. Equipment is the backstop. Behavior is the just the way to prevent injuries. And in terms of short track speed skating, I still believe that if you go in, slide into the boards very rigidly, as if, you know, I'm scared, I'm gonna, that's a big help. And with all these great new safety systems, you'll see kids slide into the pads in a very relaxed fashion.
Because they think it's going to help them out.
Right. Yeah. But that's exactly a recipe for getting hurt. Mm. So, I mean, I fell all the time when I started speed skating. So this informed me as a researcher. And I was always like, because we didn't have great pad systems when I started.
Yeah.
And so it hurt. So you tensed up. Well, it turns out that probably helped a lot.
I've always heard the opposite, actually, which is strange. I imagine a lot of people have.
So that what do you mean?
That being relaxed is better for preventing injuries.
It depends. There are circumstances. I wouldn't say, you know, any advice is 100% true. In short track speed skating, when you're crashing into pads, better to be stiff.
Mm-hmm.
I would say. And also make sure you orient your body correctly. You want to kind of go in sideways to distribute the force of impact. If you go in feet first, you're probably going to break an ankle, put a knee through your head or whatever. You know, there's a lot of things that can go wrong. So it depends. I mean, I'm sure there's some sports situations where maybe in general in sports, you want to be not tense. But when it comes to impacts, see, with impacts, and this comes back to engineering, impacts you can model as a series of springs. Just think of about a bunch of springs. Well, the board's a spring, the pads are a spring, you're a spring. And the weakest spring absorbs the most energy. So you don't want to be the weakest spring.
Yeah.
If you hit boards, you are the weakest spring. You are going to absorb the energy.
Okay.
And you're going to break. If you hit pads, pads are the weakest spring, unless they're really stiff. Now, that's why you should stiffen up, because that makes you a stiffer spring.
Right.
Okay. And then the energy goes into the pads. So that's sort of the logic.
No, it makes a lot of sense, actually. Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. Mm. That's very cool.
Like a brick wall is a spring. It's just a very stiff spring.
Yeah, just very rigid one. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So you're educated in systems design.
Systems design engineering from Waterloo. Yeah.
Okay. And then your PhD is in neuroscience. Is that correct? Is that, for that reason, for studying concussions or?
No. So systems design engineering was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it, but I came out of that not really knowing what I wanted to do. I was very interested in space, which is my tie-in to Addy.
Oh, yes.
I was very interested in space, but I didn't know how to get into it.
Mm.
I didn't have a obvious entry. So I was a little lost. And I had taken a cognitive psychology course as a fourth year elective, and I really enjoyed it, but I didn't believe what I was hearing. This was 25 years ago. They were talking about little men in your head running around doing things. Yeah. And I was going, no, that's not happening, obviously. So I started thinking, what is happening? And I started thinking about things that were very similar to neural networks, artificial neural networks, which at the time were relatively new. Back in the late 80s, early 90s. But that got me onto this neural network thing. And then I started reading about neural networks, artificial neural networks. And they were very artificial.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, well, you know, this is too much of a simplification. And then I heard about computational neuroscience, which was even sort of newer at the time. I got really interested in that. So I did my master's in computational neuroscience out of systems design engineering and kinesiology at Waterloo, working with another person from Guelph who was, you know, a local expert in artificial neural networks. And so I did a computational neuroscience sort of thesis work, and it went very well. better than my PhD. So that was fun and interesting. And okay, what do we do next? Mm-hmm. Well, one possible next step was to make the computational models into physical models. And so, you know, I was very interested in neuroscience at that point. There was a great opportunity in Edmonton with Professor Dick Stein. And he took me on, and so I went to Edmonton to do neuroscience. And it was really, I did probably more neuroscience in my master's and more sort of biomedical engineering in my PhD, but I was trying to develop a artificial muscle fiber that would behave somewhat like a natural muscle fiber. Because, you know, we have artificial everything for organs and body parts and everything. What we don't have is a good artificial muscle.
Mm.
And there's a reason for that. Apparently, it's very tough. we still don't really have a good artificial muscle. But that's what I worked on. I think I did some good work, but it did not result in, you know, some groundbreaking new artificial muscle. But I tried a technology. Polypyrrole dodecylbenzene sulfonate. If
you're interested. You'll have to explain that one.
Yeah, no, don't want to. And it did some interesting things, but it didn't do the whole enchilada. Like that's the thing. I'm not a religious person. I'm a philosophical person.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I probably, my philosophy, perhaps closer to more of an Eastern philosophy, you know, a Taoist sort of perspective on things. But the closest I've ever come to believing in God is when I was doing my PhD and I was reading about, there was a book from a fellow at UBC. He never received the Nobel Prize, but he was probably on some nomination lists, Peter Hachatzka. And he wrote this little book, it's only about 150 pages, maybe even less, on muscle fibers, on muscles. And it takes like an hour to read each page of that book because it's so pithy, it's so dense, it's so amazing. But he compares muscles from all sorts of different animals and how they work. And how they're similar and how they're different. And it's just, these are such intricate little mechanisms and machines, these muscle fibers, and they're so diverse across nature. You know, I believe in evolution, but I have no idea how that would have evolved.
Yeah.
And the diversity of that would have evolved. But muscles are amazing things. And it's going to take a long time before we can make a good one that's artificial, that kind of operates in a similar way. I mean, you know, we can have a pneumatic bag or a hydraulic pump or something, those or an electric motor. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that simulate muscles, but they operate in completely different ways.
Yeah,
I'm talking about something that contracts and expands in a continuous manner, that perhaps even suffers from fatigue. That you can have slow twitch and fast twitch versions, and sort of different sort of metabolic options on them and that sort of thing. And that they can be controlled and recruited in a similar way as they are in nature. That we're not there yet on.
It seems like a very, very complex object.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, for all the talk of AI these days, you know, artificial intelligence is great, but at the end of the day, I make the analogy of, you know, something like ALS or something, where you eventually have a functioning brain in a body that won't do anything. Mm-hmm. It's terrible. But it illustrates the point that if you have an intelligence but no way to interact with the environment, you're very limited. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be able to take in information from the environment to be adaptive. And we also need mechanisms to interact with the environment and to affect it, which is muscles ultimately for us, whether it's our muscles in our vocal cords to say something, or to, you know, grab an object or stand up and move or whatever. But we need muscles. And, you know, robots don't operate that way. And by the way that we can have smooth motions of our body parts and can do so many amazing things with them is a function of how they operate and how they're controlled, which, you know, you can't easily do with electric motors. So there are advantages. There are many advantages to the muscle as a motor.
Yeah.
And we're not anywhere near yet having artificial versions of them that are very good. And, you know, there's been 50 years of research on this so far, and we're way ahead on artificial hearts, eyes, ears.
Yeah.
Nose is probably another tricky one, but
yeah. It's so, this stuff like that is so interesting because you think about the fact that the internal combustion engine exists, but we still can't replicate a muscle accurately.
Right.
Like it's really interesting what can be done and what turns out to be an extremely difficult task. Not that the internal combustion engine, it wasn't or isn't, but.
Yeah. No, you're right. And I think people just get comfortable with solutions to things. The internal combustion engine, you know, it's been the norm for a long time, but now electric motors are becoming, are shifting that. I think, you know, in our lifetime, hopefully mine, definitely yours.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
There'll be a huge switch there. There could have been it initially, but mostly due to sort of business issues at the time, internal combustion one. But it, you know, if Tesla had had his way, it would have been a more electrical world.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't he want to send electricity through the air? Was that Tesla?
Yeah. Yeah. Microwave.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to see where things are going.
Yes.
A lot of them, like some of the ideas seem so crazy and like just nuts, but then they happen and like quickly, you know, like it seems to be, I was listening to a podcast the other day and they were talking about, how, the host said that he used to watch the Jetsons and how it was like this crazy show and most of it is like, you can do it now.
I remember the Jetsons.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say probably most of the Jetsons is now possible. My touchstone is Star Trek, I suppose, and not the original series, although, you know, it's fun, but maybe sort of Next Generation.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're getting close to a bunch of those technology, more that like the tricorder and that sort of stuff. I do think it's just a matter of time before, like, you know, the transporter will be a thing. It'll probably be inorganic for a while.
Yeah, there's been interesting, I guess, breakthroughs on that, hasn't there?
Yeah, there has. Yeah. I mean, as with anything else in science fiction, it may not happen the way it may not happen in the way that one might anticipate, but the end product will look the same. So, for example, you know, a transporter. Something goes into a transporter here and it appears over here. And everybody sort of assumes it goes from here to here. That's probably not going to be what happens. It'll probably be, it gets analyzed here, broken down. Like, you know, we'll find all the pieces and how they're put together. And then we'll make some pieces and put them together over here. And it'll look like we got transferred from here to there. But really what happened was you got rebuilt over there.
Yeah. That's the big question. That's the paradox, right? Is like, how many versions of Kirk are there?
Right. Well, that raises the, you know, as you say, the good point. Well, you could just replicate instead of transport, and then you've got the replicators in Star Trek, and you know, we've kind of got a little bit of that now with 3D printers and stuff, which can print not very good food, but it's starting to print food, metals, plastics, you name it. So. We are headed in that direction for sure.
Yeah. Well, I've been meaning to ask somebody that's still involved in the universities, but I haven't got to it yet. But but just about it seems like there's a huge cultural change going on right now, and with the students, is it noticeable? Like, do you like? I hear about it all the time, but I've never seen it myself. So is there...
I think there's two or three cultural changes going on right now. Which one are you referring to?
fair enough. I guess just the cultural change and people wanting to be accepted no matter what.
Yes. Yep. I wrestle with this personally because I do think we should all be accepted for, you know, who we are. That nobody should be discriminated against for, you know, race, religion, gender, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think in some cases that's gotten mashed together with, I can do anything and I'm entitled to do anything and you can't complain about that. And I'll give you an example. I play soccer a lot now.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a pickup soccer group. And there are some people who play more aggressively, even violently. We've had some fights, some injuries lately.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, most people don't want that, but the people who are doing it think, well, you know, I've paid my fees and I'm entitled to be here. And, you know, the paying your fees and whatever and being a student or a staff member, yeah, that does entitle you to be there, but it doesn't entitle you to stay there if you are going to be violent and violate social norms and whatever, mm-hmm. which then gets to what are the social norms? And this is where things get messy because, like with soccer, for example, there are very different philosophies of, you know, what is soccer? I think you can say the same thing about hockey or some other sports. You know, fighting is an integral part of hockey. I don't think so, but some people do.
Yeah.
And in soccer, some people would say an integral part of soccer is heavy physical contact. You know, pushing, grabbing, you know, sliding, whatever.
Sure.
And I do accept that in certain situations that is part of the game. But, you know, we're like, this is a rec pickup thing and we got some older people and nobody wants to get killed over lunch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But some people don't accept that. They say, you know, soccer is very physical and, you know, I'm allowed to be here and do whatever I want and get out of my face.
Mm.
And that is getting more difficult to deal with. And in teaching engineering, we want to welcome a more diverse group of students and people into the field. I'm very enthusiastic about that. Sometimes it's challenging to do that. Sometimes students come to us who, by any measure, are not prepared to succeed no matter how hard we try to help them.
Yeah.
And it's maybe not their fault, but, you know, for whatever reason, you know, they've arrived and been accepted, admitted, and they may not really be ready. And we need to help them get ready instead of just discouraging them by, you know, they fail out in the first year or something. This is a tricky problem.
I imagine. Yeah. Yeah. There's no other way to put it, I think, really. I think there's probably a lot of people who don't have the right expectations as well.
Right. I think, and I don't want to be too general here, but I think sometimes their high school education, you're right, has not given them realistic expectations about what is required of them to continue in post-secondary education. You know, they go, well, I tried hard, so I deserve a good grade. Sometimes that can be a factor, but other times, like in many professional programs, it's not enough. You have to perform. I mean, we applaud effort, but you need to also be able to do the skills.
Yeah.
And the sense of entitlement that, you know, I deserve a good mark, either because just the effort, or, you know, they'll say, you know, this should be worth an A or something, and it's not. There's a lot of challenging of those sorts of standards and norms these days. And, I mean, we get a lot of parents calling us now at university.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I'm so sorry.
So, that's interesting. And, you know, the other thing which is very interesting is that a lot of students who maybe have some challenges in first year and maybe complain quite a bit, perhaps, within a year or two will go back and look at themselves and go, I was immature, I didn't know what was going on.
That's good.
And they will mature.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, they think they're right. And they seem more willing than in past years to be vocal about that. And, like, you know, I kid you not, there are sometimes students now, if they get a bad mark in an assignment, they'll go to the dean and say, you know.
Oh my goodness. Like, holy smokes.
In my generation, you wouldn't have dreamed of doing that. Yeah, like, right? That would be the height of a few different things, but nothing good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, we seem to have lost some norms there around
that work ethic, kind
of behavior and work ethic. I mean, there are lots of great students, and they're also suffering in this situation too, because, you know, we're trying to help the students who need help to stay in and succeed. But sometimes that's at the expense of the top students who need to be challenged.
Right.
Yeah. So they have to be a bit more self-starters in that respect now. And that's another dynamic.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear about it, because, like, I don't know. I don't really have any friends I don't really have any friends that I've witnessed behaving or acting in those type of ways. So it's interesting to me, because I just, like, if I got a bad grade, I remember there was an essay I wrote in English class, and I was quite choked when I received my grade for it, because I had gotten all this feedback on the previous essay, and then I worked much harder, but the grade was lower, only by a couple percent.
Right.
But I would have never thought to have, and this was, like, I don't know, this was only, like, last year or the year before, I would have never thought personally to go and complain to the TA or the professors. Like, obviously, like, they know what they're the ones marking the paper. In my head, I was like, hey, I need to change something. This is graded. And I don't know. So it's just interesting to me that people are taking it beyond that and being like, no, it's their fault, not mine. So.
Well, I mean, it's a very complex issue, because we often don't see in ourselves the behaviors that we don't like in others sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I think back to my first year, some of us complained a lot about the grades. Never to the dean.
Yeah.
Rarely to the professor.
Yeah.
But sometimes to the TAs, you know, this wasn't marked fairly. See, it was done correctly. And I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I, you know, at the time, I think we were right. Mm-hmm. We got marked unfairly. I know now as a teacher, sometimes I or a TA will mark something incorrectly. And, you know, I'm more than happy to fix something that's been done wrong.
Well, like you said too, I think the most important part is that you said you'd bring it to them and show, look, this was done correctly. Right. That needs to be a part of that. It can't just be, no, like I feel like this should have been higher grade.
Right. And I agree 100%. I mean, quality, timely, specific feedback is super important in education, anywhere in education. Teaching, coaching, whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
The system is making it very difficult, increasingly, to provide high quality, timely, specific feedback, because it takes a lot of time, and time is money. And you know, this is a system that is stressed financially, whether we're talking about the primary, secondary, or post-secondary systems.
Mm-hmm.
But without good quality feedback, it's difficult for learners to learn. And that is an ongoing challenge and perhaps a growing one. And we're trying to come up with ways to provide that. But I don't think there's any good shortcuts. And, you know, just giving multiple choice tests and, you know, this is the right answer, that's the wrong answer. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, you might not be getting a lot out of that. And second, it's probably not a clearly evaluating skills you want to develop.
Right.
Yeah. You need people to do the work and look at that work and give them feedback on that work. But that takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And the system makes that difficult sometimes.
Well, then on top of all of those issues, I imagine that you're probably asked to take on more students pretty often.
Yep. Yeah.
So I'm sure that doesn't help at all.
Nope.
So
I mean, and there's another thing. If standards are high enough, taking on more students is not necessarily a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the sort of incremental load isn't so great. But if taking on more students is taking on more students who are unprepared to succeed, then everybody loses. The students lose, the staff loses, the other students lose, like everybody loses.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make sure we're admitting students who have a realistic chance of success. And this is where we run into the whole diversity challenge, because some communities are not necessarily having the same opportunities to be ready, and they should have those opportunities. So, you know, one way to do it would be to provide targeted sort of prep programs to mm-hmm. ready them to come into university. And there are some of those types of programs. We need more, we need better, but there are some there. And I think those are vitally important to get more Indigenous students coming in. In the case of, say, an engineering female students, it's been sort of a stubborn problem to raise the number of female students in engineering. There's some success, but it's moderate. I think the issue is different. I think a lot of female students are very well prepared and very capable.
Mm-hmm.
It's just they don't want to go into engineering, or they're discouraged for one reason or another. Whereas maybe in certain circumstances, some rural situations, some Indigenous students, they just don't have the opportunity to be prepared well enough. So maybe the universities have to, again, provide some of those, you know, pre-first year training programs. But, and that's easy to say, but let's face it, if you haven't learned the basics of mathematics or good reading and writing skills for a long time, I'm not sure one little prep course is going to really...
It takes a lot of time to figure those things out.
Exactly. Yeah. So it, this is a big challenge, and there are no easy answers, mm-hmm. I don't think. And there are no cheap answers either.
Everything costs.
And you hear a lot of rhetoric these days. Like, I read this daily circular about development of educational programs across Canada post-secondary. And I'm almost disillusioned by it now, because, you know, they're creating, the marketing departments are saying, you know, 2 years, you can become great at this. Mm-hmm. Well, no way. That's impossible.
Yeah.
Like, you might get introduced to it, but like, there's just so much hype and marketing that oversells stuff now. And
I see that. Yeah.
It's, I think that, like what you were saying earlier, it affects expectations.
Mm-hmm. You have been working on trying to make the first year program in engineering a little bit, I don't know how to put it, because it's not easier, but you're trying to make it like
better.
Better.
Let's go with better.
Yeah.
You're right. Not easier, but better.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. We've been, started about 5 years ago. It took a few years of intensive work. Joel Fry and I were doing a lot of that, and then we brought in some other people like Xiaobo Huang, and then some more staff more recently. And then last year was the first year of our new first year. And it has a lot of radical changes for engineering, at least. I mean, there are some other programs like vet med, medicine, for whom some of these changes are not that radical. They're familiar with them. Mm. But for engineering, this was unusual and radical. Competency-based assessment. I'm a big proponent of that now. Yeah. So that was a big change. Not having a regular schedule, that was another big change. Mm. That's something... All of these innovations, for us at least, are needing some ongoing sort of refinement and tweaking. But I think we're on to something good. The student feedback we've got has largely been very positive. That's so good. That's encouraging. With competency-based assessment...
And that's opposed to achievement-based?
Well, I can best illustrate it by an example. In a regular course... the weighting of the course, you know, maybe 50% for the final, 20% for assignments, 20% for midterm, 10% for labs, whatever. Right?
Yep.
That sounds familiar? Mm-hmm. Yep. In competency-based assessment, it's not like that at all. The weights are attached to learning objectives or learning outcomes.
Right.
So for example, your ability in my statics course to work with moments and use them in static analyses... that's a learning outcome. And that might be worth, you know, 5% of the course grade. So how does that work? Well, we're going to ask you questions about that throughout the course. And how you do on those questions that focus on that, that's how you're going to get your up to 5%. One of the cool things about competency-based assessment is that if we ask you a question like that 3 or 4 times, we really only care how you finish. Like, if you don't get it the first time, that's okay. Maybe don't even get it the second time, that's okay. But the last time we sort of question you and have you demonstrate the skill, if you can demonstrate that skill effectively at the end, great. So for example, if you kind of failed, and then, I don't know, did perfect on the last one, you'd get perfect.
Okay.
You demonstrated that you have that competency. Mm-hmm. So one of the nice things from a student perspective is you don't have to demonstrate it perfectly every time. You don't have to demonstrate it perfectly initially. We just expect by the end you can
demonstrate. You need to understand this before you move on.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that gives students time to develop a skill. Mm-hmm. We also have what we call top-up opportunities. So if even at the end of the sort of the regular sequence, they don't have it, we give them another opportunity. Mm. Sort of a makeup test, if you will. Students really like that because they realize, okay, if I don't get on the first try, I got second and third chances.
Yeah.
And so that's nice. They also know what they're being tested on. They know what they're supposed to learn. Like, how many times have you gone into a final and you go, well, I'm not sure what's going to be on this final?
Plenty of times. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But with competency-based assessment, we tell them there's going to be a question on this, on this, on this, okay, on this.
Yeah.
And why wouldn't there be? Why shouldn't it be that way? I mean, we want you to be able to do this. Mm-hmm. So we're telling you that. You can study for that. You can practice for that. And then you can show us whether you can do it. There's nothing wrong with that. That's how it should be. And competency-based assessment aligns perfectly with a teaching system called constructive alignment. And it's like the two are made for each other. Constructive alignment is the idea you've got assessments, you've got teaching activities, and you've got learning objectives. And those three things have to be aligned. I mean, how many times, you pretty much just said it, how many times have you done a test where you go, we were never taught that? Or you have a test and you go, they never tested us on, you know, something you spent a lot of time studying for. Mm-hmm. Those are cases of non-constructive alignment. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, they tell you what the course is going to be about and then half of the course is on something else.
Yeah.
So that's not aligned with the learning objectives. or they don't teach you what you need to know. That wouldn't be aligned either. So all these things are relatively common occurrences, mm-hmm. right? I mean, heck, I did these as a teacher. But with competency-based assessment, it works with that constructive alignment. You teach what's getting evaluated. You teach to your learning outcomes. You assess the learning outcomes. You make sure everything fits together. Mm-hmm. And competency-based assessment, where students know what they're getting tested on, they know how they're doing, it's fair, it works better, mm-hmm. they learn better, and they like it. It's just, it's more complicated to keep track of grades.
Yeah, I imagine, yeah.
Yeah, it's actually a nightmare. But that's one of the, there's only two downsides to competency-based assessment. It's a nightmare to keep track of grades, mm-hmm. and we're working on that. And the other one is it's a lot more marking, which, of course, given what we were just talking earlier, is a challenge.
Yeah, it's difficult.
Because it takes more time, and time is money. Mm-hmm. And you need people who can grade. Like, we're doing some automated stuff for very, very simple things. We get TAs to sort of mark the simpler integrative work. And then we mark the tougher stuff. Mm. But I mean, we still have work to do to optimize the system, but it seems to be working pretty well.
That's good. Well, anything like that in its first infancy is going to need some work, right?
Right.
But no, that seems really good, and it's nice to hear that somebody's working on something like that.
Well, and as I said, I mean, medicine and vet med have done it for a while, mm-hmm. and you know. We should all be glad for that. Mm-hmm. In medicine, can you do this or can you not?
Yeah, that one's pretty important.
You want them to be able to do stuff.
Yeah.
Not just, you know, have a pot shot sort of final exam where mm-hmm. you might have touched upon some things. And that's the other thing, too. In the past, as an instructor, and probably you as a student, you can relate to this. I mean, if I ever got 60% in a course, I usually felt like I didn't understand anything in the course. Mm. I just got by on part marks or something.
Yeah.
As a teacher, if I have students getting 60%, I know they can't do a whole pile of stuff, but they still pass. Yeah. With competency-based assessment, you pass if you can do things, and you don't if you can't. Now, we reduce the number of things they have to be able to demonstrate and show. We tell them what they're getting tested on. We teach them to what they're getting tested on. We give them multiple opportunities, but they have a higher standard of performance. 50%, they have to be at what you would normally sort of call like a 70-75% level to pass. Yeah. They have to show they can do the basic stuff. Mm-hmm. They can't, they don't pass.
Yeah.
So that's the trade-off. So like you said, it's not easier, it's different.
It seems like it is better though. It seems like so.
Yeah,
that's good. You mentioned curling at the beginning as well. You're studying or researching curling.
Curling physics, yes.
Okay, and
why?
Yeah, well, I did curl at one point, so okay. I do have some interest in it. But what about curling?
Okay, so curling's kind of neat. Did you ever hear about the bumblebees? Like for a long time, physics couldn't explain how bumblebees could fly.
I thought that was made up. I didn't know that.
It's real. Yeah.
Okay.
Physicists could not explain how bumblebees could fly.
Yeah.
But they figured it out.
Okay.
Well, curling's kind of similar. As you know, having curled, if you throw a rock and it curls in a certain direction, right? Mm-hmm. Science cannot explain that.
Mm.
Because if you do the same motion on a table like this, like if we take, I'm not going to do it because it might spill. But if I took this and this glass with water in it and spun it and shoved it down towards you, it will curl in the opposite direction.
Right. Yeah.
Now we know why that happens on a table. We do not know why it goes the other way on ice.
On ice. Okay.
There are several theories, all of them with problems. So there's no clear answer as to why curling rocks behave the way they do.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of neat that the basics, the basic physics of a game like curling is not really understood. So we're doing some research on that, and it also gives some practical benefits, like how to sweep better and or brush better. I guess it's called brushing. Yeah. Times are changing.
Yeah.
in curling as well. But it's fun, and I'm working with somebody, Eugene Ritzik, an older gentleman who was a Canadian champion, and he probably was a scientist in a previous life, because he always has 100 ideas a minute.
Yeah.
Oh, we should do this. We should do this. We should do this.
That's awesome.
He's fun to work with, and he's very knowledgeable. So it's very enjoyable and fun. That's and great. Students like working on it too. Yeah. Like, I try to involve some students in it.
Awesome. Do you know about the YouTube channel Smarter Every Day?
I think I've heard of it.
It's run by, I can't remember his last name. It's run by a guy named Destin, I believe. And he's a missile engineer. I believe he's a weapons engineer in Alabama.
Hmm.
But he's done a video on that. And
on curling?
Yeah, on that topic, actually, specifically. And it was a very good video. I can't remember what his conclusions were. And I don't think he ever claimed to have solved the problem or anything like that. But he just did a video on that topic, on how it's peculiar.
There are a few videos out there.
Yeah.
Like, there are a bunch of videos out there that sort of illustrate the challenge in understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some good instructional videos, you know, here's how curling works and whatever, but they don't get to the detailed physics. They just say, you know, if you rotate the stone this way, it goes that way, et cetera, et cetera. But they don't say why.
Yeah. I don't know if I don't think he said why, but I would recommend checking it out. He's, I'm often pleasantly surprised by how far he gets into a topic. Like, you just put it on and then end up learning. For me, at least, I'm not a scientist, but I end up learning quite a bit of stuff. So
I'll try and check that out.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here. I think I got everything I needed out of that interview. So.
Well, you know, my connection to Addy, he was the one who introduced me to you and you to me. He and I got together through the CubeSat program. So we have there's a satellite program that's going on at the university. Students are developing a satellite, so that was the connection there, and so that brings me back to remember I went through systems design. I wanted to get in the space industry, and that didn't pan out. So now you know it's coming back.
No, that's awesome. I got lots of time. We can keep going. Do you want to tell me about it?
Well, just I can tell you a little bit about it. The Canadian Space Agency started this program about 5 years ago, inviting universities across Canada to propose that they could build a CubeSat. And a CubeSat is a satellite made of cubes.
Made of cubes?
Yeah, the cubes are 10 by 10 by 10 centimeters, so they're very small.
Yeah.
And so there's like almost like a small Kleenex box or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I was approached by a physics professor who said, you know, I don't have time, but do you want to supervise this? And it won't take any time at all.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Okay. You don't have to know anything? Because I didn't. And neither did the students who started it either.
Mm.
None of us knew anything about how to make a satellite. So the students worked hard, proposed this. We put it together, submitted it, it got accepted. We worked with SAS Polytech.
Nice.
And got it going. And our project was special because it was almost all undergraduates who were doing the work.
Wow.
Yeah. Like I was more of a project management advisor, working with the project managers, helping with finances, helping with bureaucracy in the university, that sort of thing. But the students did all the grunt work, all the technical work. And they're one of the few teams across the country that's mostly undergraduates. There are one or two others that are largely undergraduates, but I think we win for most undergraduates and
least, the majority of least team is
other people.
Yeah.
At least professors and postdocs and PhDs. so it's been largely undergrad driven. And you know, COVID didn't help any, but 5 years in, we're looking at a launch early next year now, and it's That's been incredible. Exciting. Wow. And now we're in another week or two, the proposals are due for the second project, so there'll be a sequel, and we're applying for that. And so we'll be working with the University of Regina this time. I'm sure SAS Polytech will get involved again, but initially they're not able to be on the proposal, but I'm hoping we'll get them back in once we get rolling. But University of Regina will be joining us this time, and so that's good. And I'm quite optimistic we'll get a sort of a second mission. Nice. So our first mission is 2 cubes, so it's 10 by 10 by 20
centimeters.
Yeah. And it's a radiation detector and a radiation protection system. Those are being evaluated, and a little camera. And the next one will be a 3 cube set, so 10 by 10 by 30. That's what we're proposing.
So these are very small satellites as far as...
Yeah, but still very complex.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, I'm not trying to take away from it at all. No, that's really interesting. I didn't know that they put objects that small in space.
Like, yeah, CubeSats are becoming very popular. I mean, one of the reasons they went with CubeSats is that they're very modular. You can buy a lot of off-the-shelf components, so you don't have to make everything yourself.
That was my next question.
Well, and our students have done a combination of buying commercial off-the-shelf stuff and making their own things. What we've learned, I think I anticipated this to some extent, but maybe not as much as... I should have. And a lot of the students didn't think, you know, oh, this won't be that bad. It's been very difficult, and everything that can go wrong has. and this is, it's totally Murphy's Law. And the same's happening for teams that are all professors or all grad students. Like, space does not discriminate. It punishes everybody.
Yeah.
So it's been great learning experience for the students. And, you know, Addy was one of the key members and sort of the middle of the program. Mm. And the current students right now are trying to get the satellite out the door to get it to launch. And so it's been very exciting and a great learning experience for everybody.
Yeah, I bet. So what are the implications of it? Is measuring radiation, you said?
Yeah, so the students are building the satellite, but we actually have 2 professors that have contributed the radiation payloads. Mm. And one payload is this radiation detector, and then the other is a protective covering to protect from radiation. So they kind of go together.
Mm-hmm.
The advantage of the radiation detector is it's much less expensive than current solutions. So if it works... it'll be great because it's much more inexpensive than the alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
So that'd be great. The protective covering, if it works, it will provide a mechanism to help people in space, as well as electronics, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, as we start with the Artemis mission to go back to the moon, and the Chinese have their space station, and I don't know if the Russians will ever... get back on track, but you know, there are other countries, India, even the UK is starting to launch stuff now, from their home territory. Like, you know, space is growing, and the space industry, and more people are going there, and you know,
even the private sector.
Yeah, Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin and SpaceX, and everybody's going.
Yeah.
But if you're going to go back to the moon, if you're going to go to Mars, radiation is going to fry everybody.
Mm.
So we have to figure out how to prevent that.
Yeah.
There, space still wreaks havoc on the human body. And radiation is one of the main ways. There are other problems to solve too, but radiation is right up there. So if this works, it would be very helpful.
Mm.
And it's actually sort of a semi-organic material as well, so that's kind of neat too.
Hmm.
But that's what they're trying to test. Can they measure radiation, and then can they protect from it?
That's very interesting. Is it true that they discovered bacteria on the outside of the ISS? Sorry, I know this is a little bit
on the outside.
Time. Yeah, I'd heard that. It was in like
definitely inside.
Yeah, it was in all like, over the place. This was not a reputable source that I had heard this from.
But I have not heard. I follow the Aerospace Dailies. I had not heard that before.
Okay, yeah, that's but what I was asking.
It's a living petri dish inside.
Yeah,
like they've got all sorts of super bacteria in there. And, yeah, after 20, 30 years, it'd be like, it'd be kind of like having a gym bag that you open after 20 years. It could be pretty gross.
Perfectly insulated and sealed too. Yeah. Oh, I actually never thought about that. It probably doesn't smell too great.
I would imagine it doesn't. I also imagine they clean it as best they can.
Yeah.
But I imagine there's limits to that.
Yeah.
So I would not imagine it smells very good. But I also would imagine I would be really surprised if there was bacteria on the outside of the space station.
That's what it was like. I'd heard it and I was like, that's seems a little bit,
because you've got no oxygen.
Yeah.
You've got a high radiation environment. You've got huge fluctuations in temperature. I would say almost 0% chance. Yeah. Like there are some bacteria that can live in Earth on Earth, you know, Antarctica, undersea vents, things like that. But they don't have fluctuating temperatures. They're not exposed to huge radiation.
Yeah.
If there's not oxygen, there's sulfur or something else.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure about that.
Even if it was just like a bacteria, wouldn't the fluids in the cells just also keep expanding?
Absolutely. And, I mean, you go through big swings in cold and heat, depending on your exposure to the sun.
Yeah.
Like we're talking minus hundreds to plus hundreds.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's, I am not putting any money on that one.
Yeah. No, fair enough. Yeah. Well, I had one more question, but it slipped my mind. Is it cube satellites just because cubes are the best shape for it being modular, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, you can put things in a cube and then it can be modular, like you're saying, like, you know, whether it's propulsion system or communications or whatever. And because it's the same dimension cube all the time, companies can form around.
Right, you know
what it's called. Hey, we make cubes for doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So we can buy stuff off the shelf, but if your payload's unique, which, you know, most payloads are, then you got to start tweaking those things. Mm-hmm. Now, there are starting to be constellations of CubeSat satellites. Like, you know, you've probably heard of SpaceX's constellation of satellites for their internet communication service, and others, Amazon and some other ones, are being developed. Now, those are not cube satellites, but there are some constellations of cube satellites starting to come up, and as the capabilities increase, it's literally like a Pez, you know, the candy Pez dispenser. They just pew 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 pew. They just kick out these little cubes.
Oh wow.
As you know, the rocket takes them up, like a SpaceX rocket will at least bring up 50 at a time of their satellites and just go pew pew pew.
I had no idea. I didn't realize. Wow.
They just spit them out. In the case of cube satellites, like the Canadian CubeSat program, they'll actually go up to the space station and then the space station will spit them out. So an astronaut will sort of manually, not literally throw them, but just like pew pew pew. There's a deployer.
Yeah.
And and if all the satellites were the same, so in some sort of global communications constellation, if they're all the same, you could literally mass produce the satellites, which is what SpaceX has been doing. I mean, all their satellites are essentially the same. They can mass produce them and get huge economies of scale.
Yeah.
They launch 50 at a time. They spit them out into their orbits with their Pez dispenser. And that's how they get their economies of scale.
Is there any issue with the quantity of satellites?
Oh, yeah. So I can finish here today with my one prognostication.
Sure.
There's going to be a disaster in space, and it'll be soon.
Yeah.
And I'm not the only person who believes this. A lot of people in the space industry believe this, but it was something I think that was easily foreseeable 10, 15, 20 years ago. And only now is it getting serious attention, but probably too late. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of satellites now in low Earth orbit, and wow. There's plans for many, many more. And then you have idiotic things like Russia with anti-satellite weapons and China leaving some junk in orbit or whatever. Mm. Not that the Americans were perfect in the past, but like, you know, there's some dumb things still being done, especially the anti-satellite testing, which just creates debris. And you can imagine if some of that debris were to hit a satellite and then the satellite sort of explodes and then you've got thousands of pieces of that
satellite. It just becomes exponential.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then you get this cloud.
Mm-hmm. And then what do you do at that point?
And then you do nothing. You've essentially lost the use of low Earth orbit.
Yeah.
And that's, I am sure that's going to happen. And I think a lot of people are in the space industry also believe that as well. Mm-hmm. We have to get dead satellites down. We have to get pieces that are not doing anything down. We've got to deorbit stuff. Like, you know, you send a rocket up and the useless stuff stays up there. That can't happen.
Okay. I didn't know that happened, actually.
Well, there's a lot of junk up there. I mean, a lot of the pieces of a rocket do come back to Earth. Some burns up. In the case of the Chinese big rockets right now, not all of it burns up. and that's scaring some people.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of junk up there. And it only takes... Like, it'll be just this cascade of impacts and explosions and failures if and when it happens. And I think it's just a matter of time. Like, this... The International Space Station literally has to move out of the way of space junk periodically.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm, and that takes a lot of energy to move it because it's big. It has to move out of the way of space junk from time to time.
Yeah, it's probably costly. Yeah.
Yeah, very costly and dangerous. And
are there any decommissioning strategies?
There are. One of the neat things they're looking at right now is getting up essentially a tugboat, if you will. They'll go and attach itself to a piece of junk and then sort of spit it downwards so that it goes and re-enters the atmosphere and burns up.
Yeah.
There's a couple of companies working on that right now. So we got to get this under control. But, I mean, it's such a mess that it's even been speculated that, for example, Russia, even though it would hurt them, it would hurt, you know, the West more. That they would just blow up something in low Earth orbit say, screw low Earth orbit. It can't be used. If we can't use it, then nobody can. you know, as a war tactic. So that kind of stuff is kind of scary. But low Earth orbit's getting very busy. And the other aspect of that, which I don't know if you've experienced yourself, go, you know, on a clear night, look up in the sky.
You see so many of them.
You see more stuff now. Yeah. I've seen, I think they have been SpaceX actually, sequences of like 7 or 8 dots going across
the sky. Yeah, the Starlight ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, Starlink. Sorry.
Starlink.
Yeah.
And there's like 7 or 8 in a row. It's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're an astronomer, it's not that cool because astronomy is getting difficult because of all the satellites.
There's stuff in the way. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's another thing. Astronomers are not big, big fans of the 10,000 satellite constellations because it ruins their work.
I don't think most people know about this. Like, I knew that there was a lot up there, but I didn't realize it was that much. Like,
well, there's systems that look for junk so you can move out of the way, but they can only see stuff that's 1 or 2 centimeters big.
Right.
And the smaller you go, the more stuff there is. So space shuttle, space station, they've been hit by, you know, flecks of paint, which almost go through the...
Yeah, something that small moving that fast is still,
very dangerous. Yeah. But, you know, the U.S. Space Command and other, or Space Force now, and other organizations will track anything that's, you know, a couple of centimeters or bigger. Mm-hmm. And if you're in the way, they'll tell you, you should get out of the way or you're going to get hit. They also track asteroids, and things that might hit the Earth. And you might be familiar with the DART mission that just happened a few weeks ago, where they sent a satellite to hit an asteroid.
I was not familiar with this,
actually. To redirect it.
I didn't know.
And it worked.
Really?
Yeah.
I knew that that's been like a topic for a long time. Like, I knew about that.
Yeah. But, yeah. Well, they did the first real test, and it happened a couple of weeks ago. I mean, it took 5 years to get it to happen, but of developing the satellite and launching it and getting it to hit the asteroid. But they did hit it, and it moved, and it worked better than they expected, so it was good.
Was this a problem?
No.
Okay.
It was not an asteroid that was going to hit Earth.
Yeah.
But it was a test of what it would take if one was going to hit Earth. You know, could you just fire something at it to change its trajectory? And this wasn't like a nuclear weapon or something. It was just, it was like a size of a small fridge.
Okay.
Just hit it.
Yeah.
And that was enough to change its trajectory.
Well, that's good that it doesn't have to be massive. Because I think there's a lot of people that, maybe not a lot of people, but I had heard the idea one time. People were like, why don't we just fire nukes at the asteroids? But then I think that there's like a multitude of issues. And one of the big ones was that like, if you just break it and then you've got a whole bunch of smaller problems to deal with.
Right. Well, I mean, it could work, but like you say, you know, it's less predictable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, how close are you to Earth, and how big is the object? How big is your nuclear bomb? Mm-hmm. There's so many things that could go wrong there. But yeah, that's still something on the table for sure. But this was just, let's throw a snowball at it and see what happens. And it actually worked pretty good.
Yeah, I guess it's Occam's razor, right? If it's simple and it works, then...
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah. And that's a nice thing to finish on. Occam's razor.
Yeah. No, that was awesome. Thank you so much for being here. I that was great. Yeah, I learned a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Oh, and then, actually, sorry, before I cut the recording, is there anywhere that you'd like to direct people to find your research or anything, or... Just...
Actually, no, I'm working on it. Maybe in another 6 months I might have a half dozen websites set up, but I've tended not to do a lot of that. People find their way to me, like, you know, Googling or whatever.
Yeah.
I haven't spent a lot of time on a website. I know I'm bad for that, but
no, that's fair enough.
But University of Saskatchewan College of Engineering, you can find my information there.
Great.